VONews Remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. In news regarding the global coronavirus pandemic, the United States has passed the 5 million mark in terms of numbers of cases than any other nation. The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation in the U.S. has released a model predicting nearly 300,000 deaths by December 1st if Americans don't start consistently wearing face masks. That's almost double the number of deaths recorded to date. The group's director said that if 95% of Americans started wearing masks, more than 66,000 lives would be saved. Brazil and India respectively followed the U.S. in terms of number of cases. This weekend, Brazil became the second country in the world to pass 100,000 deaths from the virus, again second to the U.S., which has more than 162,000 deaths. Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, says, though, that he has a clear conscience despite the toll. Bolsonaro himself survived COVID-19 last month and says he has done everything possible to save lives. In Britain, new mask mandates went into effect this weekend, with people now required to wear masks in most indoor settings. Travelers arriving in Germany from European regions with high infection rates must now undergo virus testing. And in France, the government is reporting that 70% of those who have gone on vacation have chosen to stay in France. Secretary of State Tourism lauded his people for helping to revive the tourism sector. And the Japanese city of Nagasaki has marked its 75th anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombing, with the mayor and some survivors urging world leaders, including their own, to do more for a nuclear weapons ban. Today at 11:02, they stood for a moment of silence. This is VOA News. Belarusians hit the polls today to vote in a presidential election in which opposition candidate Svetlana Tikhanovskaya is challenging the five-term authoritarian president Alexander Lukashenko. Tikhanovskaya, who is a 37-year-old stay-at-home mother, entered the race after the May arrest of her husband, opposition blogger and presidential hopeful Sergei Tikhanovsky. She promised to free political prisoners and to for new elections. Her husband was charged with attacking a police officer and organizing mass unrest and has rejected the charges as provocations. Although Tikhanovskaya lacks political experience, she's a teacher, she quickly emerged as the country's top opposition figure and Lukashenko's strongest challenger, with tens of thousands of Belarusians supporting her bid. Election officials registered her, perhaps not thinking she was a contender. They refused to register two other presidential challengers who were male, one a former diplomat and the other an ex-banker. Those two were jailed. Lukashenko has been in power since Belarus declared its independence from the Soviet Union in 1991. Many Belarusians oppose what they call his autocratic rule and criticize his handling of the coronavirus crisis. Sri Lanka's former president, Mahinda Rajapaksa, on Sunday took the oath of office as the country's prime minister for the fourth time. President Gotabaya Rajapaksa, Mahinda's younger brother, led the swearing-in ceremony at a prominent Buddhist temple on the outskirts of the capital, Colombo. The Sri Lanka People's Front, led by the brothers, secured a nearly two-thirds majority at last week's parliamentary elections, which allows them to make constitutional changes and strengthen the family's rule in the country. Britain appointed a commander on Sunday to lead its response to illegal small boat crossings across the channel from France and said it was exploring tougher action after a spate of migrant arrivals, including 15 vessels bringing 151 migrants to the UK on Saturday. Taking advantage of calm sea conditions, migrants, including children and pregnant women, have made the dangerous crossing in recent days in rubber dinghies and other small vessels. Interior Minister Priti Patel said the UK was working to make the channel route unviable when she named Dan Mahoney, a former Royal Marine, as Britain's new clandestine channel threat commander. UK and French officials are set to hold talks on the issue next week. Britain wants France to help stop the boats and return them, and France wants Britain to help pay for it. This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman in Washington.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
I will address the issue of the fundamental freedoms and the human rights. And once that is done, Tanzania will be on track again. It will be a respected country again. And my name will be remembered that I came in and fought again for the liberation, second liberation of this.
Tanzanian opposition party ACT Wazalendo endorses former Foreign Minister Bernard Membe as presidential candidate for the upcoming elections.
The people, yes, true, we are spreading the gospel to both people. People have to be responsible, but the police has to be responsible and accountable, and there has to be justice for the people so far hurt by police brutality.
A Ugandan rights activist plans to petition the Inspector General of Police over police brutality.
We are trying as much as we can to get our supporters not to conduct themselves not properly so that they can do that. So in a nutshell, we have regular intercourse with INEC on how to go about resolving some of this problem, and that's what we also activate.
And the Inter-Party Advisory Council, or IPAC, calls on Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari to stop a breakdown in law and order in Edo State. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Tanzania, the opposition party ACT Wazalendo has endorsed Bernard Membe, a former Tanzanian foreign minister, as his presidential candidate for the October elections. The former top diplomat was expelled from the governing party, the Chama cha Mapinduzi, or CCM. But Membe says his plans to challenge incumbent President John Magufuli for the party's presidential nomination led to his expulsion. He says the incumbent president remains unpopular due to draconian laws and measures which he says undermine freedom of expression as guaranteed by the Constitution. Membe tells me that there is clear evidence that Tanzanians are tired of intimidation and harassment from the government, which he says would lead to a total rejection of the president in the upcoming elections.
Well, the people of Tanzania have already started smiling because they are expecting very good things from me. First of all, their second liberation. Look, in the past 5 years, we have witnessed people being afraid of even visiting their relatives, afraid of writing what they want to write, afraid of expressing themselves in the parliament, in the judiciary, and everywhere, in the print media and the electronic media. So I'm bringing their second liberation, second freedom that they fought for in 1961, and 5 years later, it was being sabotaged, and I'm bringing freedom to them.
But Mr. Membe, do you think ACT Wazalendo has the capacity to challenge the CCM, the party that you have belonged to, which has dominated the landscape in Tanzania since independence?
We have done the research of 21 African countries which had the political system, not political parties, that dominated their countries over decades. They failed because when people say we are tired, no matter how small the party will be, they will be gone. And that is what happened in this continent, in Zambia, in Uganda, the majority of countries in Southern Africa, Western African countries. Once people say, no, we are tired and we want our liberation, we want our independence, nothing can stop them from prevailing. And that is exactly what is going to take place in this country.
Are you saying that President Magufuli, the incumbent president, is beatable in the October elections?
He is very, very beatable. Please, just stay tuned and listen to the music. He will be beatable, and there is nothing short of that.
A lot of journalists and human rights groups are saying that the political space has been limited and that the Constitution is being violated, the freedom of expression is being limited. What specific measures are you going to put in place to ensure the Constitution is respected?
Exactly. One, that we will have the debate closed, the debate of the Constitution. Look, we had 5 years ago started the debate of having the new constitution. My government will bring about that debate, that program, and we will discuss the constitution to make sure that this country is ruled guaranteed by the constitution and the laws of the land. That's one. But number two, we will definitely adhere to the fundamental freedoms, which fundamental freedoms are the freedom of expression, judicial independence, and the freedom of people going where they want to go, and the freedom of speaking. So this will be brought about in order to guarantee that the fundamental freedom. But not only that, there is also an aspect of human rights that have been strongly violated. We will put in place the mechanism that will stop anybody from abusing his power or from violating the human rights. Once the human rights are guaranteed, once the fundamental freedoms are guaranteed, and once the constitution is reformed and brought to a new one, I'm sure the Tanzanians will not only smile, but they'll be enjoying themselves.
What makes Bernard Membe a top diplomat who represented Tanzania as a foreign minister? What makes you uniquely qualified to become Tanzania's next president?
The whole world, as you have just said, knows me. The entire country thinks my name. And I have demonstrated in the past 10 years when I was serving as their foreign minister that, number one, I'm clean. I don't have any scandal of corruption in this country. Not one. Not one. But number two, I'm a diplomat whose job is not to isolate this country as the regime today is doing. My role is to really engage Tanzania with the world at a regional level, at a continental level, and at a global level. There is no isolation that will help Tanzania. We need to be engaged, and we need to cooperate with other countries of the world. But three, economy. The economy has gone so bad, and the Tanzanians know how much I can fight for the economic welfare of our people in this country. So I will address the issue of international relations. I will address the issue of economics, to bring our economy up again. I will address the issue of the fundamental freedoms and the human rights. And once that is done, Tanzania will be on track again. It will be a respected country again. And my name will be remembered that I came in and fought again for the liberation, second liberation of this.
Bernard Membe is the presidential candidate for the Tanzanian opposition party, ACT Wazalendo. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. Still in Tanzania, Tundu Lissu, a prominent opposition figure in Tanzania, has picked up nomination forms from the Electoral Commission in the capital, Dodoma, Saturday. It was his first trip to the city following an assassination attempt when unknown gunmen shot him several times nearly 3 years ago. Picking up the nomination forms enables Lissu to officially represent the main opposition party, Chadema, in the upcoming October elections. Attorney Lissu, a former parliamentarian and a former president of the Tanganyika Law Society, says he is confident he can defeat incumbent President John Magufuli in the presidential poll. John Mrema is Chadema's director of communication, foreign affairs and protocols. He tells me that his party remains confident that if the elections are credible and transparent, Tundu Lissu would defeat President Magufuli.
Yes, Mr. Tundu Lissu, our Chadema presidential candidate, has picked his nomination forms from the National Electoral Commission together with his running mate, Salum Mwalim Juma from Zanzibar. He has the forms now, and right now he is looking for the sureties for his nomination forms because he needs about 10 regions, and each region has to be supported by more than 200 people.
But do you think Chadema has what it takes to have the 200 sureties in each region?
We have more than that. Even if they will say that they need 10,000 people, 100,000 people per region, we have these people in thousands. And that's why even today, other candidates, they were not escorted by people. But today, Dodoma stand up for more than 3 hours because the Mr. Tundu Lissu was going to the National Electoral Commission. And the evidence is everywhere in the social media, in the media. People organized themselves. Lots of people, they have escorted him more than the people who were present in Dar es Salaam airport when he was coming back from Belgium.
So what does Tundu Lissu bring to the table for Chadema to compete against incumbent President John Magufuli in the polls?
This election is all about freedom of people. Because since 2015 general election, this country, a lot of people, they have been denied their freedom. Media has been denied their freedom. And Mr. Tundu Lissu has the record that has been there fighting for the freedom of people way back 1990. So this is the person Tanzanians trust. Secondly, Mr. Tundu Lissu is going to unite the nation. He is a uniter and he's not a divider. And so because of what happened to him and the statement he has given out from our convention that he's not going to go back to look for who did what, but rather he wants to stand and move forward. As a nation, we have to forget what happened and then we move forward. Everybody understood him. But also, Mr. Tundu Lissu, he's well known as a human rights activist in this country for so long. Environment is not good. Investors in the sector of oil and gas, they are not here at the moment. Kikwete did a lot to bring them in the country. But since Magufuli, all the investors in the sector of oil and gas in Lindi and Mtwara, in Indian Ocean, they have moved. They have shifted it to Mozambique. So these people, they need someone whom they can trust that if we agree, he is not going to change the laws as what has been done by the incumbent. That's what Tundu Lissu has brought on the table.
So do you think he can defeat incumbent President John Magufuli in the upcoming election?
It is very true that CCM has been there since independence and they've been there alone doing politics after independence 1961 until 1992. We were a single party state. But since 1992, we've been allowed to have multi-party politics. If this election is going to be free and fair, Mr. Tundu Lissu is going to win a landslide victory. Because even the CCM people, we have seen them coming out now saying that they need their freedom back.
Are you expressing concern that perhaps the Electoral Commission might not be transparent in organizing a credible election come October?
Yes, although they have been keeping on promising that the October election is going to be free and fair. We are waiting to see the nomination forms for the parliamentary candidates and the local council councillors so that we can see if what they are preaching it is true. And also we are waiting to see if they are going to nominate Mr. Tundu Lissu to be a presidential candidate, because giving him the nomination forms is one thing, but we are waiting when we return back the nomination forms on the 25th of August. We are expecting the Electoral Commission to nominate him then as a candidate. That's what we are waiting. And also, today, Mr. Tundu Lissu is in Dodoma, but from tomorrow, he's going back to his region, Singida, and then he will start looking for the people to support his forms countrywide. And we are expecting a lot of people, thousands of people, to support him.
John Mrema is Chadema's Director of Communication, Foreign Affairs and Protocols. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and Africa Center for Disease Control say we can all help fight the corona pandemic by wearing face masks that cover our mouths and nose when we are in crowded places or areas. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest news on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
In Nigeria, the Inter-Party Advisory Council, or IPAC, has called on President Muhammadu Buhari to ensure there is law and order ahead of the September gubernatorial election in Edo State. IPAC, which represents all political parties in the country, warns that a breakdown of law and order will plunge the state into chaos and violence. The statement followed reports of political upheaval in the state in the run-up to the election. Some members of the IPAC say both the governing All Progressive Congress, or APC, and the main opposition party, the People's Democratic Party, or the PDP, are to blame for the current situation on the ground. Leonard Nzengwa is the national chairman of IPAC. He condemned the tensions and politically related upheaval in Edo State, saying they are unfortunate and regrettable. He tells me that his organization has kicked into gear mechanisms that will help resolve tensions ahead of the poll.
We need to understand that the president himself is the president of the Federal Republic of Nigeria, as well as the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. And is also a leading member of the APC, which is the incumbent party in power. And so wearing these different caps, the president is positioned appropriately or properly to address this issue, because in most cases, what we see in Nigeria is that when we get a talk down from up there, people tend to sit properly and do what they are doing. And so what has happened so far is, and there are allegations from different quarters that the president is not giving a clear directive to his troop, political troop, to, you know, to stand down there, what they're doing in that state. And so there's a need for us to also, you know, tell Mr. President to do something about it, and other stakeholders to do something about it.
There are suggestions that the governing party, the APC, and the main opposition party, the PDP, are to blame for the ongoing concerns of violence in Edo State. What can you tell me about this?
You have the older political parties currently made up of the APC and the PDP, and the new generation political parties, of which I belong to one, called the African National Congress. It is largely a question of the two major old political parties being responsible for disrupting this. But we're still trying to get stronger evidence to conclude that they're actually responsible for this.
Mr. Zawa, a lot of people have condemned what they described as the instability, political instability in Edo State. But as IPAC, what mechanisms are you putting in place to resolve these concerns?
We have an inbuilt mechanism where we try to engage, or where we engage directly with all stakeholders, the leading political figures in all the political parties. We have regular meetings, we have communication outfits, we have other informal avenues with which you relate and discuss issues like this. And so apart from that, there are clearly stated guidelines which way to follow and which way not to follow. So what we have done so far is we are talking directly with these leading figures and all the political parties, not only the two political parties, but other political parties, on the need for everybody to conduct themselves properly, on the need for all to obey the rule of engagement, and for everyone to ensure that their supporters conduct themselves properly. So what we're doing is we are trying as much as possible to make sure that the election in Edo State is free and fair. The thing is that the politics in Nigeria is slightly different from what obtains in various parts of Africa, and the reasons are historical. You need to understand the multi-ethnic nature of Nigeria. You also need to understand the multi-religious phase of Nigeria. You need to also understand the economic difference and other tendencies which live actively in this environment. So the blend of all this is also part of the thing that is responsible. It will not come easy for us to resolve it, but we are doing all we can to see how we can resolve it.
How is IPAC going to engage the Independent National Electoral Commission to ensure that the elections are credible, they are transparent, they are free, in order to prevent possible violence during the electoral process?
What we did yesterday was a major step in this direction, to engage not only other stakeholders, but also INEC. We told INEC clearly, in clear time, they need to be firm, they need to be honest, they also need to be on the path of the people. Besides talking in this manner, we have regular meetings, rigorous engagements we have with INEC on a regular basis. By the turn of this week, I'm going to be with the leadership of INEC, and also we'll be talking about some of these issues. So what we are doing is we engage INEC on some of these concerns. They've expressed their concern that they, based on what is happening in the polity, they are scared that they might get to a point where they might postpone it or suspend it entirely. But we are telling them that we are trying as much as we can to get our supporters not to conduct themselves not properly, so that they can do that. So in a nutshell, we have regular intercourse with INEC on how to go about resolving some of this problem. And that's what we also activate.
Leonard Nzewa is the national chairman for the Nigerian Interparty Advisory Council, or IPAC. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Still in Nigeria, a Muslim cleric has launched a campaign to combat misinformation about the coronavirus. Imam Fuad Adeyemi says a continuous public information campaign is needed to educate Nigerians who say the disease is a myth. Some also say the disease is aimed at attacking the country's major religions such as Islam and Christianity. The skeptics argue that movement restrictions imposed by the government to solve the spread of the disease are aimed at preventing worshippers from going to the mosque or to the church to pray, thereby undermining their faith. For more about his efforts to combat misinformation about the coronavirus, I reach Imam Fuad Adeyemi in the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos.
We have so many misinformation about coronavirus, popularly called COVID-19. There are some people who believe that this sickness is a myth, that it is not real. And because of that, they live their life normally as if nothing is happening. Then also, there are some people who also believe that when you use anything to cover yourself, they see you as an unbeliever. For example, a man wanted to carry a woman on a motorbike, and the woman asked him, "Where's your face mask that I will not be able to climb your motorbike?" Like, he said, "Are you an unbeliever?" Besides, there was even a situation one day that we were giving people hand sanitizer for their hands, as popularly known. They were using it to rub their body, thinking that this is a perfume.
I understand some people also are saying that this disease is aimed to either prevent people from going to churches, or some Muslims believe that it was also used to prevent them from worshipping.
But for worship, the Muslim will tell us that, "Imam, can't you see that this sickness, they are saying that it is targeted to stop the spread of Islam? They do not want us to practice our religion the way it is." And a Christian will also tell you that if one, in the first instance, did not allow us to go to churches, and now they allow us to go to church, they will say not more than 50 people will come. They will also say you should not stay for more than 1 hour. They say, "Can't you see this is a direct thing to stop the word of God?" They now see that this is a direct thing. So it did not allow them to even listen to whatever anybody is saying. But thank God, with the little efforts we are making, the narratives are changing. Even from government side, many people believe that it is just a business that government wants to do, that they just want to use it to make money. And the group of people are actually making money from this.
What about the issue of denial that this thing does not even exist and that there's no COVID-19, there's nothing like a global pandemic? What about the issue of denial?
Yes, there are so many people, as I'm talking to you now, I use an example of somebody who does not even use face mask, and in fact, somebody that asked him to use face mask is an unbeliever. That is to tell you that there's nothing like this pandemic at all. And there's so many people like that that will tell you that there is nothing like pandemic. There's nothing like any sickness. Some people say just the ordinary malaria. I remember there was somebody I met in a program. He wanted to shake hands. I said, "No, we have to build from our elbow." He said, "So, Imam, so you two believe in this lie?"
With all these misinformation across Nigeria, how is your organization able to combat this? What specific measures are you using to combat these misinformation?
Yes, we started with the Quranic verse that in Islam, life matters. That you do not know anything does not mean that that thing does not exist. And in the worship, from the Islamic context, worship starts from when you are alive. That let's agree that you don't agree that this thing is there. First and foremost, just be alive first. And when you are alive, you'll be able to pray, you'll be able to go to mosque, you'll be able to do so many things that pleases God. But when you are under the ground, you can't be able to do that thing. And those who are saying that this is creation of the Western world, that they want to stop the religion, we always tell them that look at the United States of America. The number of job loss in that country is a million. That if because of this, the American can lose jobs, you should know they love economy more than any other thing, then it means this thing is real. And people began to listen to us. They began to appreciate what we are saying. And also, personally, I also lead it. I use face masks when I want to address them. And I make sure that I don't hug anybody. I don't shake hands with anybody. And no matter where we are, there must be that social or physical distance. So when they see me doing that, then people are not being convinced that true, this thing is very true.
Has the misinformation reduced because of some of your activities?
Definitely, it's highly, highly reducing. It's because many of them are also big people among their people. So when I'm able to convince the leader, the followers will follow. So we're having a lot of changing in the narrative. For example, during the fasting month of Ramadan, we had television program. We have jingle on the Nigerian largest television station, Nigerian Television Authority, warning them on what to do, how to do things. And by God's grace, it's working.
Imam Fuad Adeyemi is a Nigerian Muslim cleric. He spoke with me from Lagos.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and U.S. Centers for Disease Control say coughing and sneezing can spread COVID-19. Physical distancing, staying at least 1 meter away from people outside your family, can protect everyone. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. But first, a leading member of the Ugandan Women's Protest Working Group, a human rights organization, plans to present a petition to the Inspector General of Police, Martin Okoth Ochola, Tuesday. Nana Annette Namata, also known as Mwafrika Mbarikiwa, says the petition demands that the chief of police address what she says are the ongoing incidents of police brutalities against civilians. Her remarks come after she ended a one-week hunger strike aimed at pressuring the chief of the police to address allegations of police brutality. Critics say the police have been using excessive force and in many cases committed gross human rights violations while enforcing movement restrictions. The restrictions were imposed by the government to help contain the spread of the coronavirus. Nana Annette Namata, known as Mwafrika Mbarikiwa, tells me that it is unacceptable for the police to be brutalizing civilians in the name of enforcing law and order.
Yes, true that I've broken the hunger strike, and sadly, it doesn't seem to have driven the message to the ones that really needed to respond to it. Sadly, they didn't respond.
Did you say you plan on having another demonstration to force the Inspector General of Police to address issues of alleged police brutality in Uganda?
Yes, Peter. We did. True that after the hunger strike, there was intent, if indeed, as expected, there was no response from the Inspector General of Police. And yes, Tuesday, we expect to deliver a petition to the Office of the Inspector General of Police calling for his attention on several matters, especially to do with police brutality in Uganda and the whole violation of rights. Tuesday it is. That's the day when we expect to take the citizens' concerns and thoughts about police brutality in Uganda.
How optimistic are you that your petition will be acted upon, particularly when your five-day hunger strike to pressure the Inspector General of Police to come out to address concerns and criticisms of alleged police brutalities didn't appear to have gone well?
As I said before, the response or no response is indeed not a surprise to me or to any Ugandan. True that there is no guarantee that it will be accepted in good faith, because we have seen before the journalists have attempted to deliver their petition when beating them and flogging them had really become too much a few months ago, and they were resisted and beat some more. There is no guarantee that the petition will move smoothly to the Inspector General Police, but that does not stop me or we or Ugandans. We have called this, again, the citizens' petition, the citizens' direct concerns, the citizens' language to the IGP to address police brutality in Uganda. It might not be received well, but we are still going to go through with it. We are delivering a petition on Tuesday to the Inspector General of Police.
What do you say to critics who are of the opinion that you should rather educate the people in Uganda not to flout the restrictions imposed by the government to limit the spread of the coronavirus, instead of presenting petition to the Inspector General of Police complaining about what the police have been doing to enforce the restrictions as part of the effort to stop the coronavirus in Uganda?
Talk the issues of the people with the Uganda police. It's not just about enforcing the corona restrictions. This covers a lot of the brutality part. It didn't just start with COVID-19. Several years before, police has brutalized people even before COVID-19. True that people are trying their best to follow the regulations. Yesterday, we had a new law passed. It's now criminal to be found in public, whether in your car, alone, a private car, without a mask. How it is now a crime to be found without a mask. But you will remember that government promised masks to the citizens, which promise hasn't come through to so many parts of the country. True, the people also have to bear their duty to be responsible, to be in the right place, to do the right thing. But I mean, we have elections coming. Trying to shape the police to do their job well, to respect human rights, is also as a way to pave that people have a smooth time through the coming elections. Violation of rights by police didn't just start with COVID-19. It started way before. It's applied on politicians. It's applied on followers. It's now applied on people that weren't essential workers that were found trying to get out during lockdown. So really, the people, yes, true, we are spreading the gospel to both people. People have to be responsible, but the police has to be responsible and accountable, and there has to be justice for the people so far hurt by police brutality.
Nanette Annette Namata, also known as Mwafrika Mbarikiwa, is a leading member of the Ugandan Women's Protest Working Group, a human rights organization. She spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. In the Gambia, members of the security forces' COVID-19 frontline workers are complaining they haven't been fed while working long hours or paid the allowances that health workers are getting despite facing similar risks. For VOA, Pandere Mbai has more from Raleigh, North Carolina, here in the U.S.
The COVID-19 security task force includes soldiers, police, immigration officers, and members of other security agencies who have been assigned to enforce the government's COVID-19 health and safety regulations. They say they have to pay for their own food and get nothing extra for being exposed to COVID-19 risk at markets and other public places. They say it is inhumane for the government to use them without paying their risk allowance benefits. Major Lamin Sanyang is the armed forces spokesman. He isn't happy that the soldiers are complaining to the media about their plight.
The fact that they came to the media to even complain is something that's frowned upon in the military. You know, all your issues have to go through the chain of command.
Sanyang says it is part of the army's constitutional responsibility to come to the aid of civil authority during emergencies, and that they have been given all the gear they need, such as face masks, to protect them from the pandemic. He also says payment of COVID-19 allowances were not part of their operational mandate.
Their operations and, you know, activities as part of this COVID, you know, activities is in line with our constitutional mandate, and there is no monetary benefit attached to it. However, I may underline that or emphasize that they have been given all the wherewithals in terms of feeding, in terms of other logistics like fueling and mobility to be able to carry out their operations throughout the period.
Police and immigration officers also have been complaining. They said they were fed for 1 week, but haven't seen any food supplies since then. Health Minister Amadou Lamin Samatte, who is under quarantine while awaiting test results after being exposed to colleagues who tested positive for COVID-19, says members of the security forces are allowed to get extra pay.
The security forces are entitled to be paid allowances just like every other frontliner, and they have been paid to the best of my knowledge. I'm not aware of those who have not been paid, but really any of those people who whose names would have been missed out, all they need to do is to lay the complaints, and then they are paid. So all the security forces who are part of the response are being paid allowances just as every other person.
Samatte says all frontline workers are supposed to be paid allowances. For VOA News, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
A It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The Confederation of African Football, CAF, Emergency Committee has approved the revised calendar for the inter-clubs competitions, which was affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. For the Confederation Cup 2019-2020 semifinals, Pyramids of Egypt will play Horoya of Guinea on September 22nd at Mohammed V Complex in Casablanca, Morocco. On the same day, RS Bakene of Morocco will take on Houssa Morocco at Prince Abdallah Stadium in Rabat. The final is scheduled for September 27th at Prince Abdallah Stadium in Rabat. All matches will be played behind closed doors. For the CAF Champions League, due to the withdrawal of Cameroon Football Federation from hosting the Final Four and in line with the principle of fairness, it was decided against hosting a Final Four in either Egypt or Morocco, whose teams constitute the semi-finals. So the semi-final matches will be played on a home and away basis. The first leg matches will be played on September 25th and 26th in Morocco. Second leg matches are to be played on October 2nd and 3rd in Egypt. The final of the CAF Champions League will be played at a neutral venue in the event a team from Egypt or Morocco qualify from the semi-finals. As a result, the bidding process has been opened to member associations, excluding Egypt and Morocco, for the hosting of a one-off final. The final is scheduled for October 16th or 17th. In athletics, Olympic and World 3,000 meters steeplechase champion Conseslus Kipruto will miss the first Diamond League event of the season in Monaco after testing positive for coronavirus. The 25-year-old Kipruto had been one of 11 Kenyan athletes cleared to compete on August 14th after the French government waived their visa applications. He announced he had failed the COVID-19 protocol test on Saturday, although he said he doesn't have any symptoms and was actually in good shape. Kipruto won gold at the Rio 2016 Olympics and won back-to-back world titles at London in 2007 and Doha last year. He has a personal best of 8 minutes 00.12 seconds, with the Kenyan-born Qatar athlete Saif Saeed Shahim holding the current men's world record of 7:53.63. Following exhibition events in Oslo and Zurich in June and July, Monaco will mark the start of the competitive season. A further 6 events, including an exhibition street event in Lausanne, are currently scheduled to take place this year after meetings in Eugene, London, Paris, Rabat, Gateshead and Shanghai were all cancelled because of coronavirus. And the 2020 London Marathon will involve only elite athletes, with 45,000 mass event runners unable to take part because of coronavirus concerns. The much-anticipated contest between Kenyan Eliud Kipchoge and Ethiopian Kenenisa Bekele will take place on a biosecure closed course. Reduced fields of 30 to 40 athletes will also compete for the elite women's and wheelchair titles on October 4th. The 2021 race, meanwhile, will be on October 3rd rather than a date in April. The calendar shift from the traditional date is meant to minimize the chances of all runners being able to take part in next year's race. Finally, in tennis, the Madrid Open has been cancelled after organizers were advised by the Spanish Health Ministry not to hold it amid the city's deteriorating coronavirus situation. The clay court event was set to start in the Spanish capital on September 12th. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Let me win. Tonight.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington, D.C. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Mpuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the one who perseveres has no misfortune. I'm your host, Peter Clotet in Washington. Good evening, Africa.